My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague in black back there, Peggy Wright, and with help from our webmaster, absent in China, Iwan Wan. Our reference coordinator is Brian Carson. Daniel Peach designed our posters and is taking the photographs, and our technical specialist tonight is Jason Hatman. Our speaker tonight is a native of Western North Carolina, where her family has lived, she tells us, since the mid-1700s. Growing up, she thought about being a doctor or a veterinarian, and was most influenced by her parents and female mentors, including her aunt, grandmother, and her high school English teacher. She attended Wake Forest University, where she studied anthropology after trying out majors in pre-med and political science. She found that cultural, biological, and medical anthropology allowed her to synthesize her interests in culture and health. And after a semester study abroad in Moscow, where she studied Russian intensively, and she says tried as much as possible to go native, she returned to the U.S. and enrolled in the PhD program at the University of Illinois, graduating in 2002. She first became interested in the Ukraine after attending a summer language program for Ukrainian in Kiev in 1995, and ever since she's been traveling and researching there. In 1998, she founded the June Phillips Memorial Mission to the Ukraine, whose purpose is to assist persons and families in the Ukraine facing health crises. At Indiana University, she teaches classes in the anthropology of Russia and Eastern Europe, sociocultural anthropology, and medical anthropology. Her early research includes articles on the health impact of the Chernobyl disaster, and more recently, she's focused on the role of women as social activists in today's Ukraine and on the rights of the disabled. Her first book, Women's Social Activism in the New Ukraine, was published in 2008 by Indiana University Press and was a co-winner of the 2008-2009 prize for the best book in Ukrainian studies. Her newest book, which she tells us will be out next month, Disability and Mobile Citizenship in Post-Socialist Ukraine, shortly to be published by Indiana University Press. Please give a warm welcome to visiting anthropologist Sarah Phillips. Sarah?
Thank you so much. I'm very, very pleased to be here. I'd like to thank Dr. Coots for inviting me and for all of the sponsors of tonight's event. Another warm thanks. It's really an honor to be invited to an event like this. I was going to start out by sort of telling you who am I, but I think that was done beautifully already by Dr. Coots. I think he hit all the highlights, so I think I will just get into the kind of heart of the matter and answer the question, why this faraway place, right? So why Ukraine? And the simple answer is that it's just a really fascinating place. And as Dr. Coots said, I've been going to Ukraine since 1995. And I originally thought that I would do my dissertation research in sociocultural anthropology, which is basically the study of culture and society, right? In Russia, because I had had experience with the Russian language. I had studied in Russia for a semester. But when I got the opportunity to go to Kiev, which is the capital of Ukraine, Kiev has about 2.6 million people. In 1995, I absolutely fell in love with this country. And there were so many interesting things going on at that time that I thought an anthropologist could really get in there and get her hands dirty. So that's what I have been trying to do since 1995 is better understand this place and bring that understanding to my students and to my readers and so on. So I wanted to just sort of, in case you're not very familiar with Ukraine, I'm not going to give you a history lesson by any means, but I want to say a few words about Ukrainian history and what I think makes it so interesting as a place to visit and as a place to study. You can see, let me try out my skills here with this pointer, you can see Ukraine is the light-colored country here, sort of nestled up against the Black Sea. it has a lot of neighbors. And these neighbors have had a huge impact on the country. Probably the most important neighbor is Russia. Also, Ukraine borders on Belarus, Poland, Slovakia, Hungary, Romania, and Moldova. And so as you might imagine, parts of Ukraine have been kind of traded back and forth amongst these various countries, empires, for hundreds of years. And it really wasn't until the end of World War II that Ukraine, as we know it, sort of had its present form. Parts of Western Ukraine were part of the Polish kingdom and the Habsburg Empire. Of course, much of Ukraine was part of the Russian Empire for a long time. So you can imagine that all of this history has resulted in a huge diversity of peoples, in terms of their ethnic identification, in terms of their language use. You have Russian and Ukrainian spoken as the predominant languages in the country, but you also have Romanian speakers, you have Polish speakers, Hungarian speakers. So, you know, this is what was so fascinating for me, was the rich Ukrainian history of long ago, but also the rich recent Ukrainian history. So, of course, if we think back, way back to 1991, that was the year that the Soviet Union fell apart, and Ukraine claimed its independence. And by the time I got there in 1995, people were really asking themselves, you know, who are we, right? As a country, as a nation, who are the Ukrainians? What does it mean to be Ukrainian? Can you speak Russian and still be Ukrainian? You know, what is the impact of sort of the Soviet, the 70-odd years of Soviet rule sort of on our lives, on our government, on the way that we think, on the way that we do things? So, again, it was a really interesting time to be there in the mid-90s when people were really actively discussing all of these questions. So that's, you know, kind of my argument for why this faraway place, why it's interesting to talk about. Of course, most relevant for us is the recent history that Ukraine has had kind of since 1991, during the period of Ukrainian independence, where, you know, the state has gone through all of these changes. You have had a couple of regime changes in Ukraine by now. You've had a lot of social reform. You've had a lot of economic reform. And these are impacting, you know, the citizens of Ukraine in very different ways, depending on you know, people's work status, depending on their gender, depending on their health status. And so these are really the questions that have interested me as a cultural anthropologist, is, you know, what impact do all of these social transformations have on certain segments of the population? And so really that's what I've been trying to understand. And a friend of mine recently sort of gave me a new way to think about the research that I do. He is a lawyer who's trained sort of in civil rights law. And he said, well, you know, I really think that you're a civil rights anthropologist. And I sort of thought about that, and I thought, well, yeah, I guess I am. And so for me, a civil rights anthropology really means an anthropology or a study of the people that have been left behind. And I sort of see myself as trying to document, you know, what I would call the little histories of these people in Ukraine, who many of whom have been left behind by all of the economic and the social changes that have been happening. So I'm going to tell you some of those stories tonight. And I want to sort of bring up the point that when one does a civil rights anthropology or an anthropology of people who have been dispossessed, it sort of entails a moral obligation, right, to try to help people in whatever way is useful, whether that's just listening, you know, taking down their stories, whether it's trying to help in a variety of other ways. And so Dr. Kutz mentioned the foundation that I started back in the 1990s. And I'd be happy to talk more about that after the talk if you're interested in hearing about that a little bit. Just to sort of briefly foreground some of the stories that I'm going to tell you, my focus really has been on social movements of different kinds and on non-governmental organizations or so-called NGOs. So these are basically, you know, community organizing, community organizations, groups that people, you know, might have started with a few friends or a few family members because they were struggling and had common interests. And then oftentimes these organizations kind of mushroom, right? They kind of grow and involve a lot more people. And I think that organizations, sort of community organizations and NGOs are really interesting because they kind of telescope many things that are going on, right? They telescope the social problems that people see as sort of most impacting their lives at a given point in time. They telescope sort of the government response to those problems. And so I feel like by looking at NGOs and various kinds of community organizations, you can learn a lot about society at large. And another thing that I've found really interesting as we think about you know, the changes that have happened in states like Ukraine after the fall of the Soviet Union and as globalization has really accelerated, NGOs and sort of civil society groups in general are this place where lots of different interests come together, and it's a place where international ties are made. So you can see all kinds of networks and all kinds of international influence on the work that these organizations are doing on the ground. And so I hope as I tell you a little bit about my research tonight, you can sort of see how that is true. Okay. I talk about all of this as if, you know, I know what I'm doing and I always knew what I was doing. And it just one thing sort of flowed into another. But that's not actually the case. I mean, I didn't go to Ukraine to study social movements. I didn't go to Ukraine to study NGOs. I went to Ukraine to study sort of the thing that every Westerner knows about Ukraine, which is Chernobyl, right? The nuclear disaster that happened in 1986. It was kind of this moment where the world said, oh, there's a place called, you know, Ukraine. Then, of course, it was part of the Soviet Union. But, you know, I still have an interest in Chernobyl, and I think it's an interesting question. But I found myself trying to do my dissertation work back in 1998 and thinking, gosh, you know, this is just not working. Like, I'm just not enjoying this, and people don't want to talk about Chernobyl right now. It had been 12 years since the disaster happened, and people, they weren't over it by any means, but they were tired of talking about it, right? And they were also uncomfortable with the fact that Chernobyl kind of is what Ukraine has come to symbolize in the West, or at least it was in the 90s. So I happened to meet a couple of women, and I don't know how well you can see them now, but this is Vera, and this is Svetlana, and this is my son, who's now 9. At the time, he was 1, so this will tell you how long I've been at this. But these women just kind of really opened my eyes to what was relevant at the time, to the stories that needed to be told. And they are two women who started an organization in their area of the city of Kiev for so-called large families, families with many children, families with 5 or more children, who again are one of these groups that really felt factors mean, you know, that this sort of space of NGO organizing and claiming, you know, citizens' rights was really becoming a sphere for women. And I actually found that it was becoming a kind of form of alternative employment for a lot of women. They would write grants, right? They would get some kind of different financial support for the organizing work that they were doing. They would kind of live off the humanitarian aid and sometimes actually sell humanitarian aid to make you know, a living for themselves. So it really became a niche of women's work. So I just before I get into a couple of the stories, I want to emphasize that what I studied was not the Ukrainian women's movement per se, right? So I wasn't looking at what sort of women social activists were, how they were organizing with a women's agenda in mind. Actually, I was interested in individual women activists and their stories, and sort of the great diversity that I was seeing in kind of the effects of NGO organizing for women as a whole. And what I ended up doing for the book was focusing on 11 organizations and 12 activists. So I followed these organizations and sort of their lives, the organizations' lives, for a period of sort of a minimum of 2 years, and in some cases for 6 years. So I was really able to see sort of how these groups evolved, whether they survived or not, and what the sort of experience of being an activist had for individual women's lives, what that impact was for their future. And I'll give you some examples of that right now. But just to kind of get on to the stories, which is, I think the women can tell their stories in much better words than I can. If you'll indulge me, I want to tell you a story of one group that I started following in 1999. And it sort of really, the story of this group called For Life really gets at the heart of what a lot of these sort of citizens who have been left behind, right, in the changes in the new Ukraine, what they were arguing for. So these are my field notes from September 24th, 1999. Quote, there's a saying, I started making soup, but I ended up with something else, laughs Sophia. This is Sophia right here. As she looks across the table at me with her piercing blue eyes. I'm relieved that Sophia turned out to be so warm and approachable. During our initial conversation over the phone, she came across as a real tough cookie. And it's true that when I asked her for an interview, she grilled me over the phone for about an hour about what my intentions were. Sophia was born in 1937 in a small village in central Ukraine in the Pale of Settlement, which was the region where Jews were limited to living, making her 63 years old when I first met her in 1999. She never knew her father, who disappeared during Stalin's terror when Sophia was an infant. Before World War II, 82% of the village's population was Jews. By war's end, the number of Jews was estimated at less than 1%. One of Sophia's most vivid memories is fleeing with her mother during the war, mostly on foot, to reach a safe haven with relatives in Siberia. After reading in a Kiev newspaper about the NGO Sophia founded to protect the interests of elderly women, I expected her to be grandmotherly. Though neither a grandmother nor a mother for that matter, she is a born organizer who knows what she wants. The soup she referred to earlier was her NGO For Life, which began in 1988, with Sophia doing a few good deeds for individual lonely retirees. I asked her to recall that time and think about her reasons for becoming involved in pensioners' affairs. In Ukraine, retirees are called pensioners because they live on a retirement pension. She answers quickly, I didn't like the way the elderly were being treated by both the government and the population at large, and I told myself, you are going to be old one day too, so if you don't like how the elderly are treated now, change it. She believed that a formal organization was needed to address the increasing marginalization of the elderly, who were becoming impoverished and ill as a result of government reform and the economic crisis sparked by perestroika, Gorbachev's plan for restructuring. Sophia, along with her friends, registered For Life, a charitable organization whose membership in 1999 hovered around 150. All the members were at least 55 years old, the retirement age for women in Ukraine, and 90% were women. We have a core collective of 25 or 30 women, Sophia explains. Most of them have been through training courses and are certified volunteers. These are the women who attend weekly meetings and help me with the real work of the organization. And I show this slide to sort of point out that they're not only involved in political work, they're also helping one another on a daily basis through things like haircuts and sort of teaching one another how to do various art projects and sharing recipes and things like that. Some of the NGO's activities center on procuring humanitarian aid for members in the form of food, clothing, and medicines. But Sophia clearly prefers to emphasize the group's mission to stimulate pensioners to remain independent and pursue an active lifestyle. I take note of a hand-painted banner that stretches across one wall of the office. Right here. Emblazoned across it in Ukrainian in bright blue capital letters is the slogan, "If we don't do it for ourselves, who will?" In addition to weekly business meetings, Sophia organizes lecture series, art classes, and excursions for members, as well as musical events and monthly birthday celebrations. Sophia also stresses the importance of providing social defense for the group's members, defense she characterizes as material, psychological, physical, and legal in nature. Members tirelessly engage in letter-writing campaigns and other lobbying efforts, and they brief one another on legislation in the pipeline that will affect the lives of retirees. I ask Sophia whether she feels that elderly persons are discriminated against by the Ukrainian state. What kind of question is that? That is why I'm constantly in bad relations with them. With whom, I ask? With the men in power. The government calls us nakhlebniki, which is Russian for beggars, literally people who beg for bread money. Bureaucrats are notorious for their abuse of the elderly, she says. Her characterization indicates that the elderly are abused because they draw on an ideology of entitlement, one that is construed as outdated and Soviet. I recall a conversation I had with a Ukrainian colleague a few days ago. This man, no youngster himself, commented that the population of Kiev is dominated by elderly pensioners who tend to be conservative and who vote for the Communist Party in elections. He said, "This is what is keeping us out of Europe. This is what is holding up our progress toward becoming a democratic society." Elderly people, it seemed, were seen by many as synonymous with an outdated socialist ideology and way of life. Sophia would have none of this. As I turned to leave, she handed me a printed invitation. "You come to this special event we are holding in 2 weeks' time. It is called My Years, My Wealth, and it's an opportunity for our girls," her pet name for her fellow retirees, "to reflect on their life's accomplishments. We are inviting government officials, and we will prove to them that the elderly do not eat bread in vain. We are going to teach them that they must bow to each elderly person who walks by. I promise to be there, video camera in hand." So that's sort of the story of this organization for life, which again, this is one of the groups that I followed for several years. Unfortunately, this story does not have a happy end. This was 1999. In 2005, I attended a meeting of this group, again in Kiev, and I learned that 10 days later, Sophia died very unexpectedly. She was alone at her dacha. It was a day or two before anybody found her, and her fellow activists in the organization didn't even learn about her death until the funeral had already been held. So, you know, a lot of them and other friends that I have in Kiev commented that, you know, her passing kind of, it really went unnoticed by those very state officials and those very kind of colleagues and other NGOs that she had counted on and really, really hoped would support her cause. And actually, the first organization that I mentioned called Our House, the group that was for large families, and it was also for orphan children, I didn't mention that, they also helped a lot of single mothers. Their story also didn't have a happy end. That organization basically kind of went under, unfortunately, when they were renting a building from the city government. They couldn't pay the rent, and the city government took their that small room that you saw in a crumbling building, took it away. So they had no premises to meet in. And again, their story was very similar to Sophia's in that their calls for, you know, social justice and their calls for respect and help as members of vulnerable populations just didn't really resonate with the new policies that are slowly being implemented in Ukraine. And so for a lot of the women, you know, that I was meeting and that I was tracking, social activism was not a path to success. And it had a lot to do with the claims that they were making, which were seen as outdated and Soviet and asking too much of the state and of their fellow citizens. Again, it wasn't a path to success for some women. But for other women, on the other hand, it actually was a path to success. And you could see a big difference in the women who had been able to tap in to certain kinds of international development networks, women who had made contacts abroad and had successfully written grants, for example, for their organizations, and had really sort of taken up the development lingo and the development ethos. And I want to tell you a story of one of those women right now. Okay, so these are from my field notes, again, from July 2nd, 2002. And I think you'll see that this is quite a different story from Sophia's. It was great to spend the afternoon with Marina. She was just as I remembered her. And I apologize for the dark slide, but this is Marina right here. She was just as I remembered her. She exuded professionalism and competence and gave sensitive and thoughtful answers to all my questions. Many of them she anticipated before I even had a chance to ask. She has such a keen sense of what issues a foreign researcher might find interesting and gives wonderfully detailed accounts of the minutiae of NGO organizing. She doesn't like to talk about herself very much, but she does enjoy talking about her work. It's clear there are certain qualities she admires and seeks to embody. Definitely top among them are hard work, seriousness, and a sense of purpose. Marina is planning to leave Lilia the Valley. She says she has grown out of the children's theme. Now, Lily of the Valley is the organization that she started for children who had suffered cancers attributable to the Chernobyl disaster. And her daughter was one of these children. Her daughter had thyroid cancer, which is a common ailment after Chernobyl, especially in children. Let's see. Most of Marina's time lately has been dedicated to a new ambitious endeavor. She's involved in the work of a large coalition of disability rights NGOs as the coordinator for women's affairs. Through this work, she has gotten to know the representatives of all the major disability advocacy groups in the country and has given presentations before then Prime Minister Yushchenko, President Kuchma, and other high-level officials. She is organizing leadership training camps for disabled women that will take place this fall, and her office phone was ringing off the hook during our conversation today. Through her work with Lily of the Valley and the NGO Coalition, she also has been involved in drafting and lobbying for legislation to better protect the rights of the disabled, including Chernobyl children. During the years of our acquaintance, she seems really to have launched herself into politics, especially with her recent work on gender and disability issues. Marina said she is not putting too much stock in getting support for the women and disability theme from international NGOs because, quote, funding for women's issues is drying up, end quote. I see Marina as a good example of the upward mobility that NGO work can provide. She has really springboarded herself to a professionalized elite career in NGO work. Much of her success has been facilitated by international organizations. She's been going in many different directions in her NGO career. Her ability to stretch is impressive, and she has positioned herself to take advantage of a range of opportunities. Even though she's working with women's issues now, it's really hard to say what kind of gender consciousness she has. It sort of seems more like a grant topic to pursue than a political consciousness. Even though her primary motivation may not really be women's rights, though this is debatable, she is doing very important work, since almost no attention has been paid to the needs of women with disabilities. No matter what brought her here, Marina seems to have found her niche. It may be tempting to devalue the twists and turns of her NGO career as her NGO work as crass careerism, but she's done a lot of good. You work closely with one of Kiev's cancer treatment facilities to improve services for children with cancer. She helped 35 families with Chernobyl children acquire apartments from the state. She was a member of the team that successfully drafted legislation and lobbied the government to assign several hundred of Kiev's children Chernobyl victim status. Women with disabilities in Ukraine sorely need advocates, and Marina seems like the perfect person to take on this task. Because of some of her own health problems, she also has disability status herself. Despite the reservations one might have about many aspects of NGO development as it's playing out in Ukraine, I'm frankly humbled by women like Marina, who have been able to create a vision and muster the energy to pursue social change. If they can make a career out of it in the process, who is to blame them for seizing this opportunity? And that kind of conclusion is something that I direct to a lot of the critiques that have been made of the so-called civil society industry as it's played out in Eastern Europe. And a lot of people have argued that, you know, a lot of the civil society aid that's been given to help build democracy and help sort of grow these grassroots organizations has really resulted in kind of an elite cadre of NGO activists who aren't really concerned with what's actually going on locally and not really concerned with the fate of their constituents. And you know, I'm kind of arguing against that bleak conclusion by saying that, well, you know, in fact, people like Marina and some of the other women in my study, they were able to get skills. They were able to kind of rework themselves and launch themselves into you know, important careers. Several of the women that I included in my study became businesswomen, so they went into business, they started their own business, or they sort of went into management positions and leadership positions in business, which is quite a feat for women in Ukraine today. Some of them, like Marina, went more directly into politics, which again, Ukrainian politics is not exactly populated by a lot of women, with a few very noticeable and beautiful exceptions, like the former Prime Minister Tymoshenko, if any of you are familiar with her. So, you know, I really, the thing that I think is important about comparing these different types of stories is that it really gets at this phenomenon that I call social differentiation, as it's happening in post-socialist states, where citizens that you know, might have been privileged and seen as good citizens that were contributing a lot in the socialist state, now in the neoliberal state or in the free market economy, are seen as a drag. Right, they're seen as a drag on the economy, and they aren't valued as the same kind of citizen as they would in the past. And I think it's important, you know, to tell the story of the groups that are fighting against us, but to also recognize that, you know, society looks a lot different now than it did, say, even just 10 years ago. So, I want to move on now. I think my time's getting short here, but I want to move on and talk about my more recent project. This is the new book that Indiana University Press tells me is going to be out in the next month or so. This project was really kind of a natural extension of the project that I just told you about on women social activists. Because a lot of the women that were involved in my study actually were in the movement for disability rights in post-Soviet Ukraine. And what's interesting, or it was interesting for me, this kind of shift, was that whereas I had been studying women previously, the disability rights movement in Ukraine is really dominated by men. And this picture doesn't tell you that, but I can tell you that it's true. So in many ways, it's a very masculine movement. So for me, as a scholar of gender, it was quite interesting to kind of see that phenomenon. I just want to briefly talk a little bit about what life is like for people who are disabled in the former Soviet Union, and if any of you have had any kind of experience in disability rights movements in the U.S. or Canada, many of these challenges might sound familiar to you. The thing that people always notice when they're coming from abroad to Ukraine or to Russia, where I've also done a little bit of research on this topic, is, well, I don't see any disabled people. And that tells you a lot about societal perceptions and the social stigma that's attached to being disabled or having a visible disability, let's say. So if someone has trouble getting around, if they're a wheelchair user, if they have visual impairments, for example, that person is going to be highly stigmatized, and they're probably not going to want to go out. Their families might want to hide them. This is changing a lot, but that's the first thing that people always say is, well, you know, I never see anyone who's disabled on the street. I have a colleague, I don't think she would mind me sharing this story, who is a university professor in the city of Kharkiv. It's in eastern Ukraine. She's around 40 years old. And I introduced her to some of my friends who are in the disability rights movement and are wheelchair users. And she said to me after that sort of interaction that that was the first person in a wheelchair that she had ever met. And she was 40 years old. In terms of sort of the built environment, it's very difficult for people who are disabled. In terms of education, most education is segregated, and it's still the case that a lot of children with disabilities will not live in their families. They will live in an institution. The so-called internat system is very robust. There are about 1,500 internats in Ukraine. You know, there's almost no research has been done on this phenomenon in the former Soviet Union. So there's a lot of work to be done. And what I've done sort of for the first book is really kind of a general picture of what it means to be disabled in post-socialist Ukraine, what the disability rights movement looks like, and also the individual stories of people who were involved in that movement. So I've looked from a historical perspective and how things have changed since sort of before the Soviet period, during the Soviet period, and today. And I've taken down life histories of people for example, can tell me what it's been like, right, over the past 30, 40, for some of them 50 years, to be disabled in this society and how things have changed for them. So I just want to, again, give you kind of the short version of what activists in Ukraine who are trying to fight for the rights of disabled people are really focusing their efforts on. Issue number one, and I can't emphasize this enough, is accessibility. And so there are many, many projects now. A lot of them receive Canadian funding for improving the accessibility of public spaces, living spaces, you know, government buildings, street level kind of interaction, and things like that. Equal opportunities for education and work is another very pressing concern. In 2002, only 22% of the disabled were employed, and I have to stress that that statistic is probably greatly inflated, because there is a practice in Ukraine that is extremely pervasive, and it has to do with the quota system, in that depending on the size of a business, they are required to hire a certain number of disabled workers, and that is often falsified. And so, for example, an agreement is made between the worker and the business where that person is registered as an employee in a certain business, but they actually never come, they've never been there, they get a portion of their salary sort of by playing along with this agreement. Does that make sense? So it's probably much lower than 22%. Most of these are false hires. My friend calls this the dead souls arrangement. You have dead souls working at your place of business. Okay, deinstitutionalization is another priority. I should correct myself. Earlier I said 1,500 internauts. That's in the former Soviet Union, not in Ukraine itself. I'm sorry. Ukraine has 321 institutions. Some of them are for disabled adults and the elderly. Some of them are for disabled children. So approximately 7,000 disabled children in Ukraine live in institutions. These are also some foci of the movement. But accessibility, education and work, and deinstitutionalization are really the main priorities of most of the NGOs. I just want to show a few slides that will kind of reiterate the problems that people face and sort of how they are trying to bring public awareness to these issues. And I should also mention that the population that I have focused on in my research is people who have mobility disabilities. So it's people who have had spinal cord injuries, it's people who are polio survivors, people who have multiple sclerosis, muscular dystrophy, people who for any reason have difficulty with mobility. That's been the focus of my study. So I'm not going to say much about the deaf or the blind or people with intellectual disabilities just because that's not the focus of my study. This was an event. It's actually an annual event that's held in Kiev on Kiev Day. There's like the celebration of the city day, and there's a group that gets together and goes out on the main thoroughfare in Kiev and demonstrates how difficult it is to get around cities. And so you see people, going up and down stairs in their wheelchairs. They'll demonstrate how to use a car with hand controls, for example. They'll show how to play sports in a wheelchair. So it's basically just to sort of get people interested in, you know, what it might be like to use a wheelchair or have mobility disabilities. Again, problems with accessibility. Public transport, for the most part, is not accessible. My friend here in Lviv he's actually in a member of the local government in Lviv, and he's in charge of it. He's like the head of the accessibility commission. So he actually sued this bank because they made a wheelchair ramp that wasn't up to specifications. So he's kind of pointing that out here. Sometimes when accommodations are made for accessibility, they turn out to be just sort of a sham. And so, again, this is in the city of Kharkiv. This is my friend Andre, who's showing, oh great, there's a accessible toilet in this supermarket. And then when we open the door, we find out, well, actually they're using it as a broom closet, right? So it's just for show. He's kind of an actor. You can okay, so, you know, given this, and I'm sorry I wasn't going into a lot of details about sort of the history of why physical disability, for example, would be so stigmatized, but there is a history here in terms of kind of the Soviet approach to the body and to work, and sort of the image, right, of the happy socialist worker who is perfect and strong and will never fail. Well, people with disabilities didn't fit into that fantasy, right? And so that, you know, that sort of history and that ideology has a lot to do with how people are stigmatized today. But, you know, I want to stress that there are really important and very kind of personalizing ways that people are dealing with this stigma. And so I sort of make the argument in the book that one of the most important ways that people are changing social perceptions and actually, you know, getting things done and getting people to listen and making change is by personifying the experience of disability. And so, you know, people would tell me these stories about how, I was going to read a little from the book, but I think I'll just tell you. They say, you know, I actually went to the mayor of my town, who promised to give me an apartment on the first floor, you know, because I live on the fifth floor and I use a wheelchair and I have to wait, you know, sometimes hours in the rain for four strong men to come by and carry me up five flights of stairs so I can get into my apartment. You know, he's been promising me this apartment for years and years and years, and it hasn't materialized. He's not doing anything. So I finally went to his office and I said, "Will you please just spend a few minutes in my wheelchair, you know, and see what it's like to try to get around and see how it feels to have someone carting you up and down the stairs?" And she said, "You know, I'm telling you, that's what finally did it, you know, was that he finally understood that I'm a human being, right, and I have rights, and he's responsible for helping me." And there were a lot of stories like that where people would say, "Well, you know, it took a lot of negotiating, but people finally started to understand us or to understand me." Oh, I didn't realize this was going off the side. Don't know what happened here. So that was actually a story told to me by this man who's town had one restaurant. It only had one restaurant. It was from a really small town. And he said, "But I really wanted to go to that restaurant, right? And I really didn't want to have to ask somebody to carry me up and down the stairs to get there. So I went to the restaurant owner and I said, 'Look, you know, you might not think I have any money,'" because again, there's this stereotype that people who are disabled must be poor. And often that's true because they can't get a job and they live off their very small government pension. But it's not true for him. You know, he owns his own business, actually. And so he said, "If you build a ramp, I'm going to spend money in your restaurant. And I'll bring all my friends to spend money in your restaurant." And that's what finally did it. So he kind of made this, you know, consumer argument to get changes made. This woman, Lena, told me about a job fair that she started in her town because she realized that people with disabilities who were in her organization were getting jobs, but they were getting jobs that they were much too highly qualified. There was a perception that people couldn't use computers, that they must have, you know, intellectual disabilities, when in fact there was all kinds of work that people could do, but just those stereotypes that the sort of business owners had prevented them from even, you know, considering the fact that one of her NGO members might be able to do that work. So again, it was a personalizing kind of strategy. I'll sort of wrap it up now by saying that, you know, based on the stories that I've been hearing since 2002 from people in the sort of disability rights community, I really think that this kind of public storytelling is the way that a more inclusive society can be built in places like Ukraine, with these kinds of histories of stigmatization and real social oppression of people who are different. Because I'll just give you one more example. Right now I'm working on an article on how the disabled are portrayed in Ukrainian media. So I've been doing a study of Ukrainian newspapers sort of over time and what kinds of stories are being told in the newspapers about the disabled. And it's so interesting to see that there aren't many disabled people in Ukraine telling their own story in the media. So it's always being filtered through a journalist who often takes great license and turns the person into a hero, right? There's this heroistic tone, or sort of the opposite extreme, tells the person's story in gruesome detail, you know, that really makes you feel sorry for them. And so it's sort of these overblown images filtered through the journalistic perspective. But there's this wonderful journalist who's blind. His name's Denis Petrov, and I'm sorry you can't see him here because the photograph's sort of going off the slide. But he writes wonderful articles in a really important newspaper called the Weekly Mirror that comes out weekly. obviously. And he always starts with, you know, imagine yourself, you know, in this situation. And so, and then he tells the story through his own eyes, and he has a wonderful way of describing sort of what he's feeling, what he's thinking, the different reactions that people are having to him as a man who's blind, sort of going through life in a big city. So I really think it's sort of people like Denise Petrov who are able to get the story out in a meaningful way that are really going to change things. Another important intervention is inclusive education, obviously, but also involving, again, members of the disability rights movement in all kinds of educational programs. And I can say more about that later if you're interested. Also fielding candidates for political office. There are very few people who are disabled who are actually in Ukrainian government, whether it's at the local level, the city level, or the national level. And this is one example of Yaroslav Hrybalski from Lviv, who's becoming an important politician. So I'll just leave you with this quote that I think really kind of makes the argument that I'm trying to make. Paul K. Longmore, who is a disability studies scholar, has elegantly described a shift in values that, if broadly adopted, can transform society. This shift entails the privileging of, quote, not self-sufficiency, but self-determination. Not independence, but interdependence. Not functional separateness, but personal connection. Not physical autonomy, but human community, end quote. And it is my fervent hope that just such an orientation will characterize the next chapter of living disability in Ukraine. So thank you for your attention.
We have time for questions. Peggy?
Are educational opportunities for women now available where they can study, get a degree, and do something concrete? Mm-hmm. So that they are not always at the lowest end of the scale.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes, and the majority of people getting a higher education in Ukraine today actually are women. The question is, in what fields are they going into? And just like I think is probably the case in the U.S., women tend to go into the humanities. There are a lot of women in science these days, and there always were in Ukraine, but science in Ukraine is not exactly a high-profile or high-paying occupation. In terms of business, the numbers of women studying business and going into business are also increasing. It's true that I think educational opportunities for women are good, but they were good in the Soviet Union too. I mean, that was one of the sort of main accomplishments of the Soviet state, was educating women and getting women into the workforce. The question now is, what available jobs are there for these educated women? And again, there's also the expectation that it's a difficult question to answer. But in terms of kind of the ideology about women's roles and what women are destined to do in life, there really has been a revival of maternalism and sort of the idea that women stay home with the children. While men go out to work, and it has a lot to do with the kind of the revival of the national idea. Now there's the ideal and there's the reality, right? And so a lot of families don't possess the opportunity to let women stay at home. Interesting, and this is going away from your question a little bit, but what is happening in Ukraine today? And there's some sociological and anthropological research that has been done on this. is that given this ideal that young mothers are going to stay home with their children, and given the economic reality that that's not feasible for most young families, what's happening is that these grandmothers who remember, do you remember I mentioned that the retirement age is 55 years? So these grandmothers who have already worked out their kind of work lives, they're retired, they are working to support this lifestyle for staying at home of their sons and daughters. Many of them are going to Italy, they're going to Portugal, and other European destinations where they're working as caregivers for children and for the elderly, and sending money home. So that kind of gender and work dynamic I find really fascinating. So we'll see what happens. Yes?
Would you find that the place of the disabled in the United States was about the same as 75 years, 8 years ago?
That is what I kept hearing over and over. You know, and I don't know if you could hear the question, but it seems like the position of the disabled in Ukraine looks like it what it might have looked like in the United States 75 years or so ago. It's true that they're faced with many of the same challenges. So the everyday reality, I think, is probably quite similar. What's really different is the way that disability rights were secured in the U.S. happened very gradually, right? And so you had various kinds of legislation being developed. You had sort of a change in social consciousness over a period of, say, 30 years, right, until we finally got the ADA. And I mean, we're still fighting for disability rights in this country. But it was a long process, and people had time to digest the changes and the changes in ways of thinking about and you know, sort of, I would even say theorizing, right, disability, what it means to be disabled. In Ukraine, it's been really different because inclusive legislation was adopted basically overnight. And so when the Soviet Union fell, some of the Soviet legislation is still in place, but there was this whole new kind of package of equal rights legislation that was adopted, you know, by lawmakers, and the general public never debated it, right? They never heard about it. They don't know that these laws are on the books. And so it was, there wasn't that time, right, for sort of social perceptions to change along with the laws. And so I think that is what is really differentiates the Ukrainian case.
What impact do the social agencies, churches, have on the disabled at the present time?
Mm-hmm. It's true. The question was, what impact do social agencies like churches have on people with disabilities? It's true that there are certain groups that are very involved in sort of caregiving for the disabled, and that would be mostly evangelicals. And if you know much about Ukraine, you know that evangelical movements are really, really gaining speed there. And so anytime you go into, you know, a hospital or an orphanage, any kind of care facility, you'll see evangelicals there helping, helping the staff, helping out. But in terms of kind of widespread support, it's not there. It's not there. Yes, Brian.
I'm wondering if your research has identified certain factors that might help to explain why some of these NGOs are successful while others are not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. It depends on what kind of NGO you're talking about. You know, I mentioned the fact that those groups that are able to get some attention from the international community and get some financial support, And just kind of the cachet that comes along with being, you know, sort of recognized by international people or groups or whatever as being important, that all contributes to the success. But that doesn't necessarily trickle down all the time to, like, the social mission and its success. Does that make sense? So sometimes there might be a few people who are benefiting from that kind of international recognition and support, but not necessarily the broad base of the movement. I mean, your question brings up a larger issue, and that is, what's the relationship between these, you know, community groups and these grassroots, you know, sort of organizers and politics? Right, and we like to think that, well, these are separate things, right? We like to think, well, there's the government and the state, and then there's the community organizers, and they're kind of, you know, in dialogue with one another, but they're not sort of, I hate to say it, in bed together. I don't know how else to say it. But that's usually not true, right? I mean, there's a lot of crossover. A lot of these, the most sort of recognizable groups that are fighting for disability rights are under the umbrella of a very powerful politician. And so there's a lot of disillusionment in some cases. There's this idea that, well, there's this sort of political force that's co-opted disability rights discourse, right? And so it sort of felt like that if you're not attached to this particular kind of political force, that you're not going to get anywhere, because that's sort of where all the power is. So actually, I think local and national politics has a lot to do with which groups are going to be successful, and it's it can often be pretty messy in terms of the wrangling that goes on that has nothing to do with sort of the mission, right?
Yeah.